Hello, and welcome to the Macho Macho Man edition of Romaniacs, in which our panel will refuse to get off your fucking laptop until the police are called. I'm Dorian Linsky, and this week, among other things, we'll be looking at how the Brexit debate and national and international politics more generally have become a contest in toxic masculinity. With me are a couple of our regulars. Hello to Roz Taylor, editor of LSE Brexit. Roz, you've come back from Budapest.
That's right.
Now under the thumb of star populist hard man Viktor Orban. How is it these days?
Well, it's a very modern, upbeat city. It's just when you talk to people, you find out that it's actually becoming a really repressive state. As I say, it feels a bit like a Rome in some ways. But then you begin to talk to people and they say, well, what Orban is doing is very clever. He's managing to shut down essentially quite a lot of the media who disagree with him by locking up journalists like is happening in Turkey, but by starving that media of funds and making it harder for them to operate. And the university where I was delivering a lecture, Central European University, is run by George Soros, who is Viktor Orban's enemy number one. And that has essentially been told it has to leave because they came up with a law, quite on a technicality, that meant something about space, that basically meant it had to close down. So they're not closing it down in a direct way. They do it all via different laws, special measures, you know, all these kinds of little things.
Sinister.
Yeah.
And it's Calamara to our second regular, Alex Andreou, master of all trades and jack of none. How are you?
I'm all right.
The two men bidding to be our next Prime Minister visited Northern Ireland yesterday. Did we learn anything new about the backstop or these two lovely gentlemen?
No, nothing. We literally...
No, you can move on.
We have literally reset to 18 months ago. That's what's happened. Their plan is exactly the same as Theresa May's was 18 months ago.
But do they have a special technological solution like microbots or something?
No.
Okay. It's also been a big week for the Brexit Party's stunt MEPs making their big entrance to Strasbourg, which they discovered was quite far away. They all turned their backs on Ode to Joy like the petulant shits they are. And Claire Fox claimed that Parliament rose after half an hour when she knew full well that MEPs were going into negotiations instead and that other MPs who actually do their jobs and earn their salaries were there until 8, 9pm. Is this just the age of the trolletician? They're just going in being as sort of foul and difficult as possible.
Look, I mean, they were democratically elected. I don't think it was a mystery how they were going to behave. I don't think anyone was under any illusions that they were going to go and be constructive. So I guess they're doing what they were elected to do. They were elected to go there and be obstructive, be assholes, and that's what they're doing.
So they're earning every penny.
Yeah, they're earning, you know, nobody could do the job of asshole better than Claire Fox. So she's been sent there to do
I know,
that.
Martin Daubney.
Oh, God, his videos are hilarious. His videos are brilliant. He's like, oh, my God, I had to get on a bus and then a train to get somewhere. What is this sorcery?
It's in another country. Why didn't they tell me? Our special guest this week vies with Alex for a packed CV. Kieran Hodgson is a comedian, violinist, train spotter, impressionist, star of Upstart Crow and Two Doors Down on telly, and 3 times Edinburgh Comedy Award nominee.
Hi.
Romaniacs listeners might like to know that he's reprising his show 75, A Comic History of Britain's Relationship with the EU, at the Soho Theatre in London from 29th of July and then Edinburgh. The Telegraph says he ought to be the next Q in James Bond. Do they?
One person.
Before said this that podcast.
Yes,
they love
very,
us.
Very kind of them to say that.
Is it the wish-all thing? Got a wish-all thing going
yeah,
on.
Perhaps. I think just as sort of general nerdiness and approachability is the main qualification.
He's nerdy and he's approachable. It's Kieran Hodgson.
Morning.
How Brexit curious were you before the referendum?
I would say tremendously so. I've, you know, always been quite interested in politics in general, but I guess in a way that is more akin to someone who really likes Newcastle United but never goes to a game and always watches a match of the day every week and knows all the punditry and knows what to say in terms of the conversations, but doesn't really play football or have much mm-hmm. of a, you know, practical day-to-day knowledge. So, yeah, I'm sort of politics hobbyist. And then after Brexit, I was in a place in my career where I wanted to do a show that turned this sort of political nerdness into comedy, and my area of specialization is politicians of the 70s in particular, and so I thought, what's a way of taking that very uncommercial prospect and making it in some way modern? And fortunately, Europe reared its head at that time, so I was able to discuss that historical relationship with Europe and find a way of making it something that was
you monetized our misery, basically.
Of course, that's yeah. what so artists are meant to do, happened. Is it not?
So I believe this is how it works. When they're handing out the impressions on graduation day at comedian school,
yeah,
you got the 70s politician.
Yeah, I got
pack.
The bottom of the barrel. They put the sorting hat on my head. Please not the 70s. Please not the 70s.
But in the 70s, you could do well.
So, yeah, I spent many years on my own, surprise, surprise, perfecting impressions of Roy Jenkins and Enoch Powell and people like that, and who have very interesting voices, but which, you know, no one these days would really recognise or indeed want to hear. And so, yeah, it was a great enterprise, sort of 2-year-long quest to work out how that could be, that particular skill set could be something that was attractive as an on-stage proposition.
You really lucked out with this. A whole political nightmare.
Yeah, there were conversations with my agent when I was proposing this 70s show idea, and they ran something along the lines of, this is a lovely idea, but will this be in any way relevant 2 years down the line, which was when I was planning on doing it in Edinburgh. And fortunately, as it turns out, the show has just become more and more pertinent as the months and weeks have gone by. And while I was touring it a couple of months ago, I went through 2 Brexit dates while I was doing the show. So it, I've been very fortunate in that respect. I am now sick of it and will. I'm looking forward very
much. Give us
an
hour.
Yeah, doing. I certainly will. I certainly will. I'll give you the fruits of my years of labour. But next time I will try and do a show that is less fraught.
And in your publicity photos for the 75 show, you're wearing the famous Europhile jumper that Margaret Thatcher wore in the 1975 referendum.
Yes, very
Where
hard
to... Where did you get such a thing?
Very hard to track down in this day and age. The story behind it, apparently, I'm willing to be corrected by your listeners, is that someone's gran gave it to Margaret Thatcher. It was just arrived as a gift during the 75 campaign, and she was on the Remain, as it was, or the Yes side. And so wore it for a photo shoot, and lots of photos were taken that are now in all the books that I was reading. And then in 2016, for referendum round 2, a company called Common Market set itself up to do a reprint of these. And they only made a few hundred, I think, and they were mostly bought up by journalists and and such like. So when I was looking to do the show, I wanted to track one of these down because I thought that'd make a great photo. But there were none on sale. There were not anywhere to be found on eBay or Amazon or anything. So Twitter helped me out. I just put a request saying, does anyone know anyone who may have bought these T-shirts? And yes, some journalists came out of the woodwork and let me borrow one. So very grateful for that.
Did you feel Thatcher-esque when you put it on?
I did when I put the boobs in.
That's the trick. Tricks of the trade there. Kieran is going to stay with us throughout the podcast as we round up the latest ignominies of the interminable Tory leadership contest and then cheer everyone up with Vladimir Putin's declaration that liberalism is dead. Plus, we'll have the return of Gone in 60 Seconds, where one of our panel debunks a favourite Brexit argument in a minute or less, and the boring but important thing of the week after these quick reminders from Roz.
Following our successful Donald Tusk romantic fiction contest and our thrilling Marc Francois war story competition, it's time for a new writing challenge, and this time the genre is spy fiction. The Brexit Party's brave infiltrators are behind enemy lines in Brussels, where the iPads are suspiciously free, but who knows what spyware is on them. We want you to choose a Brexit Party MEP and tell the story of one of their secret missions. Send us 200 words of your finest Ian Fleming and or John le Carré prose to info@romaniacs.com with the subject line, The Spy Who Came In for His Expenses. And think of a good title too. We'll read out the best one and the winner will get a personalised From Brussels With Love t-shirt and mug set. And while we have your attention, are you backing us on Patreon yet? It's a good time to start. Get every edition of the show at least a day early, as soon as it's finished, plus mugs, t-shirts and a weekly column from the panel, and our monthly extra show, Ask Romaniacs, if you're on the $5 or upwards. It's the best way to keep us in rude and troublesome health. Search Patreon Romaniacs or visit our Facebook page to find out more.
Thanks, Roz. Now back to the Tory leadership. Week four of the Great British Bloke-Off, and having tried evasion, dead cats, and even trying to look like a normal, decent person, in Jeremy Hunt's case, both Hunt and Boris Johnson are now trying to outbid each other in terms of macho credentials, both promising a Daft Punk Brexit, harder, better, faster, stronger. As if the October 31st deadline wasn't close enough, Jeremy Hunt has pledged to commit to a no-deal Brexit a month earlier on the 30th of September to allow a month to prepare. Alex, do you think this is a good strategic move?
No.
Like for him, I suppose, not strict for the country, but like, for him. And
we've got 4 months and he's saying, I only need three. I mean, that's basically the bid, isn't it? He's saying, yeah, can do it in three. No problem. I'll have it done by the end of September. I mean, it's nonsense.
I suppose he's trying to look relatively, I don't know, is he relatively sensible? Is that his pitch, that he's going to allow a month at least to plan?
Well, his pitch is that if it looks unlikely we'll have a deal by the end of September, then he'll start full-throttle planning for a no-deal. But the idea that you can prepare for a no-deal in a month is laughable. I mean, European countries have been running drills in the ports of Calais, in Antwerp, in places like that, for a year now. They've issued their detailed guidance to businesses 8 months ago. It's ridiculous, this idea that we can prepare for a month. Plus, we're having this conversation and everyone is basically having this conversation with Europe listening. So it's like we're standing next to the table where we just lost our shirt saying, no, the key is to bluff better. We still have a shit hand. And they're sitting there listening. And it's like, what are you doing?
Well, Hunt,
you know they speak English, right?
Well, Hunt's sort of line is that European leaders already respect him and will only talk to him and presumably give him special treats. Is there any evidence that this is the case?
No. Absolutely none.
I'm really softballing this stuff to you.
I really have no idea where he got that from. I mean, it's fair to say that they would rather speak to him than Boris Johnson, because who wouldn't, frankly? You know, but they would rather speak to a chair than Boris Johnson.
Yeah, I mean, the problem with Hunt is that last year he gave a speech in which he compared the EU to the Soviet Union. So I don't think that's going to go down terribly well, to be honest.
It's just a very low bar, isn't it?
Yeah.
But Hunt said he'd sacrificed people's jobs with a heavy heart for no deals. He'll destroy your family's livelihood, but he'll do it with a sad face. As he said once or twice, he was himself a businessman. And destroying businesses is a bold move for any Tory PM. Is this just messaging for the nutty grassroots, or do we believe him? Because he didn't used to be a no-dealer. I mean, he used to be a Remainer back in the day.
No, I think he's struggling, really, to be a no-dealer. And this is a sign, you're seeing a glimpse of the original Remainer, because I think he voted Remain in 2016, didn't he? Mm. You're seeing a glimpse of the original Remainer kind of blinking through when he feels he has to admit that something's going to be bad. But then he quickly rose back again. It's like it's like some, you know, ghastly character and who's incredibly evil. And then just for a moment, you see the good side and then it blinks back again.
Can I just say, I know it's not relevant information, but he has a special room in his house with a sprung floor where he can practice the lambada. I promise you, I am not making any of this up. You can look it up.
This is Boris Johnson.
No, this is Jeremy Hunt.
The supple Jeremy Hunt.
This is Jeremy Hunt. He's got a special dance room with a sprung floor to practice the lambada.
quite continental.
What do we think of that, Kieran?
It's quite an old-fashioned dance, isn't it?
It's like getting the 70s comedians.
Yes, absolutely. It's sort of, yeah, it's up there with the Macarena as a sort of, yeah, thing to be practising. I don't know, I like my politicians to be fit, you know. George W. Bush was very into the mountain biking, and he was a great president. Mm.
Do you build him from the boobs up?
No, because he was always exercising.
We'll assume that Johnson would definitely win and the head-to-head campaign would be irrelevant. But it's sort of looking, I don't know whether it's a question of the media just trying to keep things interesting, but his lead does seem to be looking shakier. Definitely reports on the hustings was that sort of Hunt was performing better. Do any of us think that it's conceivable that something could yet happen which would collapse Johnson?
Rose?
No. I don't think we could learn anything about Boris Johnson that could collapse him at this point because his cult is set. However, I think that now that Tory constituencies, members are seeing him in action, they seem to be coming out of those hustings and saying, oh, well, actually, some of them at least, actually, he was a bit of a blusterer and Jeremy Hunt impressed me more and I'm going to vote for Jeremy Hunt. So I think that Hunt will do better than we expect. Yeah. I don't think he can quite push it over the line, but I think he will do better than we expect.
He will do a little bit better. I think I agree. But I just, in my waters, I sense that there's going to be more than 50% of members that literally get their ballot, their postal ballot, cross Boris Johnson and send it through that day. Mm. I really think there's over half of them that have already decided and for whom nothing will change this.
They're not the most flexible thinkers, are they?
Yeah.
Is the primary motivation, do we think, the fear factor, the fear of the Brexit Party factor, and this article of faith that I think most people seem to have sort of swallowed, that he is the only man who can bring back the Brexit Party voter? And so perhaps you might leave the hustings and think, oh, Jeremy Hunt's not so bad, actually, but I've got to look after the health of the Conservative Party in the future, and there's only one man to do that. No, do you reckon that's what is behind that?
I don't think it's
solid
that at all,
because Johnson vote?
We know from the polls that they're prepared to destroy their own party to see Brexit through. They're just obsessed with Brexit. A lot of them voted for the Brexit Party and the Conservative Party members. It's Brexit. It really doesn't... the fact is they think that Boris Johnson is more likely to deliver Brexit than Jeremy Hunt in its purest, most horrific form than Jeremy Hunt is.
Kieran, from a sort of comic angle... Boris Johnson's sort of blustering, amiable, toff kind of vibe, which he sort of maintained for several years as a kind of quasi-comedian on TV himself, seems to be sort of running out of road. And there's a sort of harder, darker version of him that you see in, like, political cartoons. Do you think that his image, in terms of how he might be kind of, like, impersonated, parodied, has sort of changed significantly?
It's... interesting you should say that. I saw a play a few weeks ago called The Last Temptation of Boris Johnson, and it was before it had been written just before Theresa May had resigned, but then was being performed just after she had. So it was quite an interesting thing to watch, because it was hypothesising about some future Tory leadership bid in 10 years' time, where Johnson was trying to put himself forward. And in that play... there was a very clear delineation between scenes of Boris Johnson in private, where he was played as far more serious, far more, you might say, Machiavellian. And then as soon as he was due to make a television appearance, he would muss up his own hair, loosen his tie, start waving his arms around. And the message of the play was clearly, look, this is all a construct. And so that was the first time I had seen the two sides portrayed, and probably the more, you might say, scheming side had the more airtime. Whereas up to now, we've all enjoyed, I think, the standard impression of Boris, which is the Bumblefest.
If you're
so maybe that is an indication of where people will go in their depiction.
Because if you're impersonating the Bumblefest or caricaturing the Bumblefest, you're kind of doing the job of that.
Yeah, we were discussing this before, in that it's a very smart move, I think, to be a character that is so comical that an impressionist cannot puncture it particularly effectively. It's a long way from, you know, Harold Macmillan going to watch Peter Cook perform him on stage. It was so shocking, the idea that anyone would dare make the Prime Minister look ridiculous. So yes, it's a very clever, you know, armament against that. I dare say Saturday Night Live will continue with the Bumblefest, because that's, you know, that's the easier way of doing it. And if you're not particularly interested in the ins and outs of our politics, then that will remain, I think, the shorthand.
Yeah.
The international code sign for Boris Johnson.
So both Johnson and Hunt are making expensive pledges. Both say they will partly fund them from Philip Hammond's No Deal contingency fund, but they both claim they're committed to No Deal as a possible outcome. So if there's no deal, how can there be a war chest?
Where's an American?
Yeah, this is what Philip Hammond has been pointing out the last couple of days quite forcefully, even from the dispatch box in the Commons. Basically, he's saying you can't spend this money that is put aside for no deal if you're going after no deal. Certainly, you can't spend it multiple times over. And certainly, you can't spend it on a yearly basis, which is something we haven't really heard discussed on the news at all. I find that quite astonishing. This is a one-off fund. If they're talking about, you know, lowering the tax rate, that's an annual burden on the revenue. Do you see what I mean?
No, but it's quite...
The thing will fund it for the first year and then that's it. Where's that money coming from afterwards?
But they sold austerity off the back of this very simple sort of household economics analogy.
Yeah.
You can't spend more than you've got coming in. But surely there's an equally effective household economics thing. If you've set aside money for Christmas presents and then you spend it on a holiday, you can't spend the same money on Christmas presents for the rest of your life.
Yes. I think that's very good.
But that seems to be the thing that they're proposing.
It is exactly what they're proposing.
Do you think, Roz, that it occurs to them to feel bad about people who literally died as a result of the austerity that they claimed was absolutely necessary because you had to balance the books, and now doesn't matter at all?
No, because those people are dead and they're therefore not complaining. And most of the people who, you know, are also in a bad way have no political voice either. I think Johnson's plan is what he always calls turbocharging the economy, which is more macho man talk, of course, to basically in some way ensure that there's an incredible economic boom that brings in so much tax revenue that we're just wallowing in money and we can cut taxes and up public spending at the same time. And, you know, good luck to him with that.
He said the other day he will put a rocket up the economy, which I find really quite disturbing language.
As an economic ignoramus, by what means is this proposed?
Because he's an entrepreneur and so he knows how to do it. Don't ask.
Okay.
Just stop it.
Oh, it's Hunt. Sorry, Hunt's the one.
Yes. Right, Hunt wants to put a rocket up the economy. I find that especially disturbing because, you know, in Greek we have gendered words and economy is female. So the image is really quite disturbing.
But that's always the answer, I suppose, isn't it? It's just like, we'll just be better. We'll just do better.
Yeah.
Like, well, you know.
Well, that's kind of the Brexit plan, isn't it? That I'm going to be better at it, therefore I will come back. And that's why I think there's a strong Remainer argument for Boris Johnson. I've been coming more and more around to this in the last few weeks because I think actually Jeremy Hunt will just be a replay of the last 2 years, because at the end of it, when he can't deliver it, it will be again that he didn't really believe in it, he was a Remainer in disguise, we need to find a proper Brexiteer, all of that will run again. Give them their hero on a white steed. Give them Boris Johnson, this true Brexiter that can deliver it. Let him fumble, and then they begin to run out of road. They begin to run out of excuses. They begin to run out of people who are the true Messiah.
And then enter Prime Minister Nigel Farage.
Well,
Anyway, let's have one of our new regular featurettes, the boring but important thing of the week, where we put the spotlight on something that really, really matters, which not enough people are talking about and isn't really boring, obviously. Roz, what have you got for us?
I've got Ursula von der Leyen. Ursula von der Leyen is nominated to lead the European Commission, a really unexpected choice. We were expecting various middle-aged to late middle-aged men to be nominated for this position, but it's her. And she is a defence minister in Germany, a big ally of Angela Merkel. And interestingly, a former LSE student. So she lived in the UK for a while. But here's a fun fact for you. She had to change her name because of her family connections. She was pretty well known, or her family was well known, and they were afraid that the Baader-Meinhof gang would target her. So she changed her name while she was studying in London so that they wouldn't carry her off and kidnap her.
That's a bit 70. For you there, Kieran. Yeah. No, did you perk up there? Bottom mine off.
Yeah, so she's... the reason some people are getting cold feet over her is partly because of some slightly dodgy-looking business over irregularities over defence contracts, but also because she's talked about an army of Europeans. Not a European army, and the semantics are important, but an army of Europeans, and some people are pretty unhappy about that. She's very much pro-NATO, so Vladimir Putin is going to be unhappy about that. All right, maybe he's going to be pleased to have someone to really take on, but it's an interesting choice.
Cool. Thanks, Roz. Support for this episode of Romaniacs comes from The Week, the indispensable digest of what really matters in news, current affairs, the arts, politics and more. In a world of multiple voices clamouring for your attention and often saying very little, The Week filters out the noise to bring you the really important takeaways so you can stay fully informed and make the best use of your time. With news, comment and analysis from over 200 sources across the political spectrum, from The Guardian to The FT to The Telegraph, The Week's razor-sharp writing means you can understand the world better and see what's happening outside your filter bubble. Romaniacs listeners can try it for 6 weeks for free in print, digital or both. Just visit theweek.co.uk/offer and use the code REMAIN. This week, reading exciting news about Boris Johnson's plans for the cabinet, which some people are saying he might slash from 25 to 12. Farewell, such unimportant posts. Diffit, business, justice, transport, work, pensions, etc., etc. Is there any positive version of this? I mean, obviously, Diffid is somewhere that they want to get rid of anyway.
Yeah, but this is fucking insane. I mean, he's going to have something like a no-deal Brexit, or if not a no-deal Brexit, because apparently there's million one chance of that, then a very, very hard Brexit. And he wants to cut departments at the same time and have all the shake-up and the turmoil that that implies at the same time as trying to cope with Britain leaving the EU. It is mad, but the impression I get, the reason he's trying to do this is to, first of all, make sure that there's no one around him who can threaten him, no one who can cast any aspersions or doubt on the cult that is Boris, and to have just surround himself with hardliners. I'm really kind of terrified by this.
May I ask a short factual question and then play devil's advocate? The short factual question is it the case that the plan is to get rid of the departments, or simply to demote the heads of those departments to being non-cabinet
and
ministers?
To merge some. Yeah, sort of stuff
okay.
like that.
Okay. And then the devil's advocate bit, just worth asking. Given Theresa May's endless difficulties with lack of cabinet loyalty and lack of cabinet watertightness, and the way in which her efforts to maintain some sort of negotiating position, both with Parliament and with the EU, were undermined by the fractiousness of the cabinet. Is there not an argument to be made that a future Prime Minister might do well to reduce the likelihood of such a difficult working environment?
Are you approving of purges?
No.
Let's just have this on the record. Pro-purge. No, I mean, presumably that is the idea.
I see what Kieran's saying in that
nobody's getting away.
It makes the conversation, I think, around the table practically very difficult when you have 25 people, and it might actually be easier if you have 12, and it might be easier to keep a lid on things and stuff like that. So I see the point. But the natural end of that curve is to not have a cabinet at all.
Great.
Look what you've gone and done. In this enlightening but increasingly dispiriting piece, The Express predicts that Steve Baker, Hard man Steve Baker would be Brexit secretary.
No.
And the Sun.
No.
The Sun adds Pretty Patel is likely to make a cabinet comeback, as is former Defence Secretary Michael Fallon, a long-term supporter. He and Mr. Johnson enjoy exchanging texts in Latin.
Can I just say that Michael...
DM per Didi.
You know, Michael Fallon, you know that company that makes the Yorkshire pudding, Auntie Betsy's?
Yeah.
Okay, well, look at the picture on the box next time.
Michael Fallon makes Betsy's Yorkshire pudding.
It's Fallon. I promise you.
So that's the kind of thing you end up talking about when you read the week. So find out what's really happening in the world. Get out of your echo chamber and challenge your own ideas and learn about Yorkshire pudding with a free trial of the week. Get your first 6 issues free at theweek.co.uk/offer. Use the discount code REMAIN and join thousands of people who trust The Week as their unbiased source for news and ideas. That's 6 issues free. Go to theweek.co.uk/offer and use the code REMAIN. Moving on, the EU referendum ruined everyone's Glastonbury in 2016. This weekend, it was Vladimir Putin's turn to harsh our mellow when he told the FT that the liberal... People were talking of nothing else before Stormzy. Did you read what Putin told the FT? That the liberal idea had outlived its purpose as the world turned against immigration, open borders and multiculturalism. Liberals cannot simply dictate anything to anyone, just like they have been attempting to do over the recent decades, Putin said in an interview ahead of the G20 meeting, where he sounded just like an excited youngster who'd just been reading Paul Embry and Brendan O'Neill. Take that, chattering classes. The Russian leader, who, as it happens, is funding and encouraging anti-democratic populist movements across Europe, went on to praise the culture, traditions and traditional family values of the alleged majority. Roz, obviously awful. But less terrifying figures have made similar arguments about the vulnerability of liberalism. Does Big Vlad have a point?
He has a point in a... Well, liberalism is vulnerable if it stops caring about ordinary people's concerns, and those concerns are sometimes seen as populist. And populism by itself is not necessarily a bad thing, because it means... What populism means ultimately is trying to shape your policies to help the people who most want to be helped and answer their concerns. And liberalism sometimes forgets to do that because it's concerned with weightier ideals, because it's... For example, an example is the Human Rights Act. Human Rights Act, anyway, is a good, great thing, but... What point does the Human Rights Act have if it isn't enforceable? And if you look at Britain today and you look at the way, for example, that legal aid has been cut, that administrative law is diminished, if you can't enforce your rights, what is the point of having those rights? You just create a kind of class of people who can enforce their rights and a class of people who are too poor to do so. And so focusing on things like human rights and you could almost say forgetting about the consequences of austerity, as we were talking about earlier, is dangerous. And that's when populists swoop in and they say, we can sort out your problems. Now, usually, in vast majority of cases, they can't. And they're just using liberalism as a way of harnessing some anti-elitist or anti-liberal feeling as they see it. They're not the solution, but they are able to use liberalism to do that.
Alice, why is he saying this?
Look, he's right in one sense, in that you can't tell someone to be liberal. You can't instruct someone to be tolerant. Liberalism is not something that can be behaviorally instructed. It has to be philosophically understood. And for 30 or 40 years, we've encouraged an education system which produces obedient economic units. It actively shies away from people who have critical thinking faculties, who question the system, who understand things deeply, who are interested in education, who are interested in knowledge, who are interested in reading about stuff. And so we have produced a generation that is largely understands things that are given to it, basically. And you can't tell someone, be tolerant. If they don't understand why there is a value to being tolerant and arriving at that conclusion themselves, you can't just oppress it into them. At some point, they're going to kick back. In this case, their kickback was Brexit. So he's right about that, but he's not right about the solution, obviously. The solution is actually to create an education system in which people, freely thinking, arrive at conclusions which encourage a civilized society.
Is Putin really only talking about social liberalism? Is that what he's really attacking rather than economic liberalism?
No, because I mean he's been quite economically liberal within Russia as well. So I think he's attacking all of it. I think what he's saying is that my model of doing things is lither and more dangerous, and he's right about that. Mm. You know, he had annexed Crimea before we wiped our ass and got off the toilet and joined everyone to discuss it. It is quicker when you have no one to be accountable to. There's no doubt about that. We just have to arrive at a system where we balance speed and decisiveness with democracy. You can't be a ditherer forever, but you also can't be an autocracy.
Which is why you need a 12-person cabinet, which is a streamlined decision-making body, but which has a representative function.
Muscular like a panther. So one fun thing about the 70s, which is a fun decade, was that around the time, actually, of the 1975 referendum, there was all this talk of, on both the right and left, of the kind of collapsing centre, and also a kind of a sort of groupieism around Pinochet. Who was it that went? Peregrine Wursthorn went to Chile and went, oh, okay, obviously don't approve of the
stadium stuff.
Stadium stuff, disappearances. But you got to say, he's getting things done. The place was a mess. And there was this weird kind of, it didn't last that long, but for a couple of years there was quite a lot of excitement in the sort of British ruling classes for a hard man, and because that didn't happen, I think perhaps a lot of people have forgotten that there was ever this sort of craving. Did you come across this sort of weird impulse?
Yes, certainly. There's a very good book called Crisis, What Crisis, written by a guy called Alwyn Turner.
Yeah.
Where he does a really great survey, not only of the politics of the time, but also a lot of the popular culture, including sitcoms. And there's a great scene in Reggie Perrin where Jeffrey Palmer plays exactly the sort of person you're talking about, a guy who is going to bring about a military coup in Britain to sort it all out because it's all gone completely to pot. And there were certainly elements of that in the during the Grunwick strike. A big part of helping break the strike was an underground organisation that helped fulfil all the orders that were being stopped from getting through by the strikers. You know, and there was this idea of pro-freedom organisations who were helping to undermine the striking workers and, you know, taking a sort of military organisation ethos in order to do it. And yeah, I guess we have forgotten about that particular aspect of 70s radicalism because we tend to think of 70s radicalism in terms of the Winter of Discontent and Arthur Scargill. And I think both extremes alarmed people at the time. Hence, you know, a strong leader was found, albeit through a parliamentary system.
Because, I mean, I suppose the difference between that we have between Britain and America is that Trump is fairly pro-Putin, and he obviously has, like, a big kind of crush on autocrats and dictators.
Yeah, he wants to ride bears naked together.
He's somebody who would happily lose the Constitution down the back of that Oval Office sofa, isn't he? Like, he's just like, really? Can I not just do what I like? But Boris Johnson has actually been very critical of Putin, so there doesn't seem to be the same... Because what happened when Trump was pro-Putin was that suddenly tons of Republicans were like, oh, he's okay then. Like,
yeah, yeah,
he created
yeah.
this huge pro-Putin constituency. We don't have that because no kind of major politics... I mean, Farage, I guess.
Yeah, Salisbury, I think, kind of queered that pitch. So I'm not sure this is an accurate reflection of how it might unroll in the future, but certainly this close to what happened in Salisbury with the poisoning, I think it would be madness for any UK politician to kind of... I'm becoming aware now that Corbyn is quite a sort of ambivalent about the Salisbury thing, but anyway, Yeah, so I think Salisbury is a big, big factor in this. I don't think any of them can cozy up to Putin.
And how worrying, finally, is the idea of with sort of Putinism or Orbanism? Actually, we see shades of that in the Brexit Party. How much of a constituency is there for that? Because I don't think every single person who voted for the Brexit Party would like to see an authoritarian hard man.
That's quite an assumption, though. That's quite an assumption.
I'm just saying not all of them.
I think making decisions is fucking hard. I don't think people acknowledge that. People long for guidance. That's why they like religion, because decisions are made for them.
And I think this is Johnson's strength in a way, because he most definitely does not represent that kind of strongman. I mean, he's not, I think, going to crack down on a free press anytime soon, for example. he's a journalist. He has enough comedy, if you like, and informality about him that you can vote for him without being afraid of that kind of slightly sinister, well, very sinister, hard man, militaristic edge.
Yeah.
So one more point. Do we think that perhaps, unfortunately, that in the short term, the sort of pushback against the authoritarians is going to involve doing some illiberal things? Isn't it Denmark where the kind of fairly left-wing new PM kind of won on with some quite hardline anti-immigration stuff, which seemed completely, you know, from an outside perspective, it seemed completely out of place with everything else that the party.
Labour tried it with that mug.
That's
true.
Mug.
Well,
hey, if they'd gotten
slogan on a mug,
this was like if they'd had the chance to enforce that mug, things might have been very different.
But this was like banning kneecaps, and like it seemed a lot harsher than the mug.
Yeah, I don't know. Denmark is weird. It was a big surprise to me because my niece is studying there, so I've been a few times, and I really didn't expect what I found. It's really polarized. I mean, there are basically the vast majority of people are soft left. And then there's this core people who are proper far right. It's quite frightening. So I guess they're trying to combat that by at least owning it. I know that sounds really weird, but there is an extent to which if you see a juggernaut moving towards something inevitably, there is value to getting behind the wheel at least. Do you understand what I'm saying?
I don't think you necessarily have to go that far, though. I think this almost takes us back to something Alain Menon was saying a few weeks ago on the podcast. And he was saying how much he admired Tony Blair's slogan, tough on the crime, tough on the causes of crime. You just have to talk the talk. You have to address both audiences at the same time. Yeah. You have to address the liberals, tough on the causes of crime, and you have to address the people who are just worried about the crime, tough on the crime. And if you can pull off that trick, and he did, I think you can get it. But there's just nobody in British politics, really, who's doing that at the moment.
Let's have another of our new regular slots, Gone in 60 Seconds, in which one of our regulars takes apart a standard Leave argument in less than a minute. I have a watch, new watch.
It's more like 65. How strict are you going to be?
No, I'm going to be very strict.
No,
I'm going to be strict.
I can't. I've practiced it. I can't.
No.
I can't.
I'm going to knock you out with one punch
no.
if you go over 60 seconds. In recent weeks, with Johnson and Hunt setting out their negotiating approaches, we've been hearing that old perennial, they need us more than we need them. Alex Andreou, if our listeners need to sync this one quickly, what can they say?
Total amount of trade is meaningless. Size matters. UK exports to the EU are 13% of our economy. EU exports to the UK are 3% of theirs. 27 countries losing one important partner is not tantamount to one country losing its 27 closest markets, as well as the entire legal framework under which it does all trade. Trade is not a favour. We buy things we need. The fact we buy more from them does not mean they need us. It just means we're not self-sufficient. You buy more from Tesco than it buys from you. That doesn't mean you can simply walk into your local Tesco and pay for a chicken with some Japanese yen, a bag of apples, some lint and a button, and then complain they're bullying you when they don't accept your terms.
Uncanny. 45 seconds.
There you go.
Wow.
I did it very fast.
You did it very fast.
I'll do a slow one for Patreon backers.
The late night version. Sink into a bath and listen to this. This week's special guest is a one-man Brexit dividend. Character comedian Kieran Hodgson's show, 75, explores how he joined the EU in the first place. In his own words, it enabled him to perfect a series of obsolete impressions and discover the 70s were about more than just Tiswas, the colour brown and the words Let's Go on Strike Again. And he's bringing it back to London and then Edinburgh. So, Kieran, we had Robert Saunders
on
a while back. We did. Mr. 1975.
Oh, he knows a lot more than I do. My friend, this is a confession, my friend, when I was about to do the show, got me as a present his book, Yes to Europe. And it was a lovely brand new edition hard book. And I put it on my set in my show because I have all the books on stage. But I still haven't read it because I was saving it as a treat for when the show was over.
Really good.
Occasionally, when waiting to do the show, I've flicked through, you know, different bits and gone, oh, God, that's not what I say in the show. Cross. But wow, okay. Is he a real brain box?
He does know quite a lot of.
Okay. I'll try not to sound like a complete
10
idiot.
Questions.
Then. He did.
No. Okay, no.
But back in school, and I love it.
I did see a very, very clever Guardian columnist actually get the year of the referendum wrong the other day. It is kind of barely understood. I just remember it because of the band. I just think the 1975.
Yep.
I believe are named after.
And then
the referendum.
In brackets, referendum.
Referendum. Yeah. Lots of people actually think that we had the vote before we joined. So, I mean, there's a lot of misunderstandings. What did you...
Jump to myth bust.
What did you find exciting about when you started going into it? Maybe the sort of things that went, oh, that's more complicated than I thought. Oh, I didn't know that happened.
Wow, there's a ton. So first would probably be the fact that our entry into... I'll call it the common market for now, because obviously... Okay, well, right. I'll do a 0.5. Obviously, in the 70s, it was not called the European Union. The European Union is a creation of the 90s. And a big part of the beef of many people who voted to leave in 2016 was that they felt they had been deceived in 1975 by voting for our entry into the common market, which had then mutated against their will into the European Union. That's... a belief. Mm. So, first of all, not called the European Union, called the Common Market. And indeed, the Common Market was a mutation of an earlier thing. So I'll just, for the sake of ease, call it Europe. So that's the 0.5. Number one, our entry into it was not easy, was not assured, was something that took a long time and various failed attempts on the part of both Conservative prime ministers and Labour prime ministers in the form of Harold Macmillan and Harold Wilson. Number two, the thing that I found really interesting was that... at the time of our entry, even though the political class, both parties, were really keen on going in because they saw it as vital to our economic future, surveys conducted of the British people at the time show a very indifferent attitude at best to joining Europe at all. So it's not as if we have come down from 2016 from some great high mountain of Europhilia in the past. Not at all. And so this rather dicey enterprise of convincing Britain and convincing Europe that this was a good idea for both parties fell, first of all, to a guy called Ted Heath, who's a very interesting man and somewhat controversial because of recent police investigations that we don't need to go into here. So his story I found very interesting. He was a guy who went round Germany before the war and then went back into Germany as a soldier in the Royal Artillery during the war, and from that drew a very strong sense of the need for a united Europe. He was the guy who won over the French, got the French to say, yeah, OK, you can come in.
Worth saying that he was somebody who did actually fight in the war.
Yes.
And
yes.
That left him pro-European.
Just...
for the attention of Marc Francois there.
Yes, absolutely. His war service was crucial, I think, in the formation of his European crusade, not a great term. So he wins over the French, and the French say yes, and he has this big parliamentary battle to get our accession through. And in this parliamentary battle, interesting thing number three or four, I've lost count, is the fact that it was the Labour Party that had the huge splits, the huge civil war over the European issue that we are now seeing played out in the Conservative Party. There was an anti-Europe wing, chiefly on the left, with people like Tony Benn and Michael Foot, and a pro-European wing with people like Roy Jenkins. And the rebels helped Heath get us in, but this led to untold calamity in Labour during the early 70s, which were only resolved by another guy, Harold Wilson, adopting Tony Benn's idea of a referendum. And Wilson's pitch was, OK, you want a referendum? Some of you. And you want to stay in? Some of you. Well, what I'll do is, when we get into power, I'll renegotiate the terms of our membership, and then we'll have a referendum about the new terms, which, fast forward to 2015, was exactly the David Cameron pitch. So I've been talking for many minutes now, but and lots taken.
Which of these impressions?
Yeah, that's right.
Which of these impressions?
Parallels are plenty.
Which of these impressions did you have raring to go then? What was in your arsenal?
I was very keen on doing Harold Wilson. And I'm now getting the nod.
Yeah, do Harold Wilson.
Do Harold Wilson. Well, that's perfectly acceptable. It's so wonderful to be getting so much time on the airwaves, which I was never given when I was in office. We were constantly barraged by the BBC and the papers who did not give us a fair deal. We were doing a lot more than they gave us credit for.
That is uncanny.
Thanks.
May I say he built him from the boobs up right in the studio.
Had you had any cause to do Enoch Powell before then?
No.
I mean, that's quite niche, right? I mean, I'm sure there's certain comedy clubs where that would go down well.
They're not to be mine.
No.
I'd never had call to do it professionally, but, you know, watching all these documentaries, you do see him and hear that voice, which I'm being encouraged to do. I'm always a bit reticent about doing it because of who he is.
You don't have to do Rivers of Blood.
He spoke with a very strange accent that is not really heard anywhere in the country anymore today. He was from Birmingham, but he spent a lot of time during the war over in India and other parts of our empire, and so had quite literally a global accent that is very hard to pin down, and a great intensity as well. It's like a lot of these people, when they got put in the TV studio, came across as huge theatrical entities because I think they were used to a more grandiose public speaking style. And watching footage of, you know, Enoch Powell sitting in a little armchair from 70s TV interviews is, it makes an impression also.
Because I haven't, I've read the book, but I haven't actually gone back and watched, like, you know, footage. Mm. And Tony Benn, our generation, and so for you, Tony Benn was this kind of, you know, quite a cuddly, avuncular, pipe-smoking figure. But he was, like, not at all in the referendum.
Yeah, at the time he was seen as a total lunatic and a dangerous man. I mean, much like many people would portray Jeremy Corbyn today, it was very much seen as a vote to stay into Europe, or you may in somehow give Tony Benn what he wants, and Tony Benn's the guy who's going to wreck the whole shooting match. He was seen as a vote. He and Powell, who ended up allies on the Get Us Out campaign, were both seen as dangerous radical men. And the third part of that unlikely trio is Ian Paisley, of course. Who I'm not going to...
No way!
Sorry,
he's not
hard
to do.
You just have to.
Nope.
Come on, just do a no. No. Go on.
Nope.
No, but can you do young Tony Benn? Because I think a lot of people, they have heard only old, cuddly Tony Benn. So what did he sound like?
Well, he sounded very much like the elder version, but with a great deal more force. And the purpose of nationalisation is, of course, the economic benefit for the whole of society, not simply for the moneyed, and for those monetarists who would seek to strip our national assets, something like that.
Brilliant. The catchphrases for the politicians—they're not as good. They're not your typical.
No, it's catchy. Isn't it?
They're not the catchphrases that you know you get from
the media.
Take
back control.
Because it was a kind of weird, like there was a weird tableau of sort of 70s celebrity, the poster with People for Europe includes Richard Briers, Arthur Lowe, Janet Sussman, whatever. I mean, they got a lot of, they got a lot of people on board.
Yes.
More success, more in a more sort of organised fashion, I think, than Remain in 2016.
Yes, I think one aspect of...
You don't have to do all those, by the way.
Oh, my Sussman is electric. That's for paying customers only. Yeah, I guess they were more organised. But the 2016 referendum, I dare say, got a lot of famous faces on board and a lot of party leaders and former prime ministers and such like, as did the 1975 Let's Stay In campaign. The difference, well, many differences, which I won't go into now. One of them might be the fact that Europe was still a relatively fresh enterprise at the time. Mm. And so if all the political leaders and the newspapers are saying, it's a good idea, everyone, say yes, I think that seemed like a more convincing argument at the time. Fast forward 40 or so years and everyone in power telling you to continue with the status quo maybe had slightly less
support. Also, our economy was down the shitter.
Your words,
which helped
mine.
The argument somewhat, didn't it? The one that always surprises me about that period is that we started EFTA. Every time I read it, it comes to me as surprising information because we thought, no, we'll start a rival.
Yes, the second
to the thing.
Whom we then abandoned.
Yeah, that we then abandoned because, you know, the community was doing much better. So we thought, oh, we'll join them, and we left the other ones. And now you tell Brexiters EFTA, they're like, oh, it's a vassal state. Like, you started it.
So this is obviously like, This is a high concept show.
You think?
Who's? I mean, there's lots of ways to sort of to skin a cat. Who do you think's doing sort of good Brexit related comedy from your point of view? And are there certain
crumbs? I hate Brexit related comedy.
Really,
I'm
like all of
avoid
it. It's
it.
All rubbish.
It's very well worn, and I think both comedically and journalistically, everyone is desperate for new angles, because it's something that's gone on for 3 years and relatively little has changed in the underlying sticking points, I guess. And one of the reasons why I took this show back into the 70s was just to try and find another angle on
it. Also because you could do the voices.
And also, there's the voices. So, no, I wouldn't want to pick any favourites on the.
Do you think people without naming names, do you think people sort of struggle that it's a topical news, because Brexit has swallowed the news? It's all of the kind of gags about the news shows. There's just like there aren't enough Brexit jokes in the world,
like including on the news. The News at 10 gets so excited when the top is some non-Brexit related story.
Yeah, do you remember
when you can see it? They get giddy.
Do you remember at Easter when we'd had this sort of 5 week period of living minute to minute on Brexit, and then all of a sudden everyone went off for Easter and pretended it hadn't happened, and joy broke out across the country. There was a million and one other things to discuss, which I think is perhaps one of the reasons for a certain desire to get Brexit over and done with quickly in anticipation of a bright morning afterwards when we'll never discuss it again.
So do you think, because, I mean, some people say, well, perhaps, you know, because it's so divisive, comedy commissioners are a little sort of nervous about dealing with it. Do you think it's more that, do you think it's that? Do you think it's the writers are just sort of, would just like to write about something else? Do you think it's fear of audience fatigue, like...
Yes, I think those sound fairly rational arguments for not putting it too much on the television. And dare I say, the nature of the topic makes it very hard to create comedy that doesn't come down on one side or the other. Mm. And I think television people are perhaps anxious not to play into the image of them as always promoting, Remain. I think let's face it, that's the view of the traditional media, is that they will always put Remain stuff on. And I think there are Leave voices that are being found and being put on television. But in the main, I think it's safer to try and make programmes about other things.
So we have to make do with the real life on the buses holiday special that is the Brexit MEPs in Strasbourg.
Absolutely. Yeah. What's wrong with that?
Great. I just took a train.
great bunch of characters. It's the end of the show, and that means something else that goes into the Brexit time capsule. Kieran Hodgson, as our special guest, what are you putting into our Noah's Ark of things we'll miss if we ever leave the EU?
Scotland being in the UK.
Tories don't seem to care about that, do they?
Well,
They did a few years ago. Now they're just like...
We'll see, won't we? It's all up for grabs.
And do you have particular fondness for Scotland?
Yes.
It's not a trick question.
Yes, I spotted your trap there. Successfully avoided it.
No,
yes.
I can't stand the place. Oh, no! And we've just about got time for this week's foreign language clip, which is close to home. It's in French from Linda Morgan.
Les candidats à la direction du Parti conservateur font tout des affirmations impossibles pour résoudre le Brexit. La réponse? Restons dans l'Union européenne. Vous savez que cela a du sens.
That means the candidates for the leadership of the Conservative Party all make impossible promises to resolve Brexit. The answer, let's stay in the EU. You know it makes sense. Bien sûr. Bien sûr. Why do I?
Bien sûr.
Bien sûr.
I don't know.
That's how French people speak. Remember to send us your European language clips. Just record something short on your phone in a vaguely quiet room and email it to us at info@romaniacs.com. We'll use the best ones. And that's the end of the show. Kieran, thanks for joining us. Can we call you back in 2059? We're working on a show called 2016.
Yes, I would love that.
And doing all the... Do you do the... you don't have to... Again, no pressure. You don't have to do any. Have you done the current... Worked on the current slate?
No, they're all
political talent.
Quite normal voiced, which is problematic. The Cameron years were very lean. I remember it was hard to pin him down on any aspect of his voice, really. And George Osborne was even worse.
On any aspect of anything, it was
well,
pin him down.
Nobody ever always. Says, "Oh, do you Jeremy Hunt?" Do they?
No. I mean, Boris obviously will be a gift for impressionists, but that's about it.
It's not a golden time. Thanks for listening. We'll be back next week. Now, please stand and contemptuously turn your back on us while we play our theme tune, Demon is a Monster by Corner Shop, and thank our latest Patreon backers.
Big shout from me to Rajneesh Jaiswal, Ludwig Tolhurst Cleaver, Rob Easthope, Eric Carles, Victoria Hart, Rebecca Bunbury, John Cooper, Ian Battersby, Colin Horsfield, and Gustavo Ordonez Sanz, our favourite font.
Thanks from me to Cole Murphy, Tim Maloney, Alessandra McConville, Lucy Carmichael, Melanie Roy, Neil Whedon, Colin Wilson, Connor Gillis, Graham Dave Baird, and Matthew Beer.
And finally, thanks from me to Joe Delaney, Thomas Askew. Askew, sorry. He's not slanted. GCU Grey Area, Chris Cook, Declan Wilson, David Von Dadelson, Paul Gallagher, Matt Bailey, Mike Wilcox, and David Anthony. See you next week.
Romaniacs was presented by Dorian Linsky with Roz Taylor and Alex Andreev. The producer is Andrew Harrison, and audio production was by me, Sophie Black, at Soho Radio. Romaniacs is a Podmasters production.